Shrink Wrap Radio number 427, exploring the participation mystique with Jungian analyst Dr. Mark Winburn.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today is Jungian analyst Mark Winburn, PhD, whom I previously interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 361 about the book he had written on the blues. Today we'll be discussing his latest book, which is titled Shared Realities, Participation, Mystique, and Beyond. For more information about Dr. Mark Winburn, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Mark Winburn, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, Dave, thanks a lot. I appreciate you inviting me back and enjoyed the last time I was there a couple of years ago.
Has it been that long already?
I believe it was, because Deep Blues was published in 2011, and I think we did the interview in 2012.
Okay, well, that show was a lot of fun because it turns out that you and I both share a love of the blues, of traditional classic blues genre. And at first blush, that struck me as an unlikely topic for a Jungian exploration, but you did it. You pulled it off.
Well, thanks.
And today we'll be discussing your new book, which is titled Shared Realities, Participation, Mystique, and Beyond. And I have to confess that the term participation mystique was a new one to me. From my reading in your book, it's clear that the term participation mystique has meant different things to different people within the Jungian community. But perhaps we can start with your giving us the most basic working definition that you can come up with, and then I'm sure you'll be elaborating as we go on. So what is the short and sweet definition of participation mystique?
Well, Carl Jung actually picked that term up from a French anthropologist named Lucien Levi-Bruhl, who was prominent at the time Jung was writing his early works. And it's particularly a term that Levi-Bruhl used to describe the relationship that native peoples, what at that time were called primitives, now we would call them First Nation peoples or native peoples of the land. There's a number of terms that people prefer now, but to describe a particular relationship that these people had with themselves and their surroundings. And Jung, you picked that up. And I'll just quote from Jung here. He says it denotes a peculiar kind of psychological connection with objects and consists in the fact that the subject cannot clearly distinguish himself from the object, but is bound to it by a direct relationship which amounts to partial identity. The identity results from an a priori oneness of subject and object. So to simplify that a little bit, what he's saying, the perceiver, the person observing their environment, that there's a blurring of boundaries between the self and whether it's another person, whether it's an animal, whether it's a geographic feature like a lake, a mountain, or a river. That for these peoples, Jung perceived them to have a blurring of boundary between themselves and these various things in their world, as though they felt in direct relationship to what might be called the spirit of the river or the spirit of the mountain or the spirit of the jaguar, for example.
Okay, well, that gives us a good start.
Yeah,
and
okay.
We'll be polishing that apple as we go along.
Okay.
But what made you want to tackle this topic?
Well, actually, this came out of discussions with several colleagues of mine that I connect with on a regular basis, and we kind of throw around ideas. And the primary discussion around this was that we noticed in the way it gets used in the Jungian community that it always has a slight, it always has a slightly negative connotation when it's used in dialogue or often in writing. And for myself and these colleagues that I was interacting with, they felt it was, or I should say we felt, that it's often a very positive experience as well. So it's kind of an overarching concept of experience that has potentially positive and potentially negative implications to it.
Yeah, and that certainly makes a lot of sense to me, and I tend to mostly come down on the positive side as well. So it was interesting as I was going through the book to see that different people had different takes on it. Now, who's your intended audience for this book? Is it strictly for Jungian analysts? I could see that it would have a lot of appeal to them. Was that the audience that you had in mind? Or?
Well, that's certainly the primary audience, the people that I think are going to pick up the book, is Jungians, Jungian analysts, Jungian psychotherapists. But my hope, because I'm interested in a cross-disciplinary dialogue with the various psychoanalytic communities, my hope is that people from outside the Jungian community will also find some interest in it, and that's why I intentionally recruited a couple of authors from the psychoanalytic world to also give their perspectives on this concept.
Okay. And is there a relationship between your earlier exploration of the blues musical genre and the concept of participation mystique that you write about here?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Because that was a central feature of why I was writing about the blues, because it has this inductive shared quality to it, where the lines of boundary between performer and audience are blurred somewhat by the shared affect of the music, literally the blues. When the singer's singing it, he's feeling the blues, and the audience is feeling the blues, and the rhythm of the music also is inductive. It pulls us into a shared, what we would call a shared field in which if there's a drummer involved, the first time the drum stick hits the drum, and a beat's established, and everybody starts tapping their foot or nodding their head or moving their shoulders in unison with the music, everybody's in time with each other. Well, that's a fascinating, it's a simple but fascinating experience that suddenly, through the rhythm of this music, everybody is now in sync. But nobody's thinking about being in sync. It just is.
Yeah, and I had that experience just last night. There was a special that I happened to come across, and I didn't get to see the beginning or the end, but it was about James Brown, and it had a lot of footage of James Brown. And boy, he was just totally captivating. You know, he's not, you know, doesn't fall within typically what we think of as the blues, but he's definitely, you know, rooted in that tradition.
Absolutely.
And boy, what a powerful guy and musician he is. Now, this to me sounds like a wonderful experience, a kind of experiencing of the oneness of the universe, what some might consider a kind of mini Satori.
Uh-huh. Yes.
You actually describe an experience that touched me that way, and I think it was the moment of, I seem to recall that somewhere early in the book you described a personal experience of seeing a leaf fall from a tree, and in that moment it affected you prominently. Do I recall that correctly? Perhaps you could take us through the experience and the impact it had on you.
Yeah, I'll just read that that paragraph, if that's okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
One of my most vivid experiences of participation mystique occurred while running one cool spring morning. The sun was low, still making its slow ascent into the dawn sky. About a mile into the run, I was beginning to settle into my stride, my body awakening to the pulse of its internal rhythm. As I entered a familiar stretch of road, completely covered by its dense canopy of rich green trees, I noticed in the distance a single leaf had discharged itself from the verdant awning. The leaf seemed completely singular, vibrant green on the top and a bold yellow on the other underside. I watched as it descended, spiraling like a slowly revolving helicopter rotor. Time and space seemed to collapse inward, ceasing to have meaning or weight in the moment. It was as if I'd entered into a visual cognitive tunnel in which time was arrested and only the leaf and I existed in some unseen communion. After a few moments, which seemed to exist as an eternity, the leaf found purchase with the earth and the enchantment slowly dissolved. The leaf once again became just another leaf. However, the feeling of communion I shared with that singular leaf has now persisted over a number of years, and I continue to experience the sensation that the leaf spoke to me in that moment and invited me to participate in its journey.
Well, that's beautifully written. And it really gives that sense of what I refer to as a mini Satori. And it also puts me in mind of Maslow and his work on peak experiences. And it sounds like that was very much a peak experience.
Right. And there's Maslow's work was continued by, I can never pronounce this guy's name because it's Eastern European, Czesleminski.
Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Yeah, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah.
I've been tutored on it.
Okay. And he speaks about, quite eloquently, about he takes Maslow's term peak experiences and turns it into low experience.
Yes, yes. Now, the moment of leaf enlightenment, if you will, was a very personal experience. You were alone. Am I right, though, that the focus of your book is on the melting of the ego boundaries in the dyadic relationship of analysis?
Yes, that is a great deal of the focus of the book. And the book has a lot of clinical examples of cases that the various authors of the chapters are presenting in which they felt this experience of not sitting back in their chair as the distant observer, but being in it and affected by it. And the same thing with the patient as well.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things that emerges in your writing about participation mystique is, you referred to Jung earlier, and is the ambivalence that Jung seemed to have about the phenomenon and the range of positive and negative emotions that seem to attach to it by other authors and clinicians over the subsequent years. So let's go back to Carl Jung, and what more would you want to tell us about his take on this phenomenon and why he thought it was important?
Well, I think he did see that this, even though he thought of this characteristic as a characteristic of primitive psychology, he also saw that modern individuals always have remnants of this form of thinking, and that these forms of thinking continue to enter into therapeutic relationships all of the time, and that if we're oblivious to them, if we're not aware of them, then they affect us in ways that allow things like acting out in the therapeutic relationship, either by the therapist or the patient, in ways that are destructive or non-therapeutic, acting out of various unseen complexes. And that when one has this concept of participation mystique, it allows the reflection to occur of all of these feelings are coming up, and what might that be telling me about what's in the field in this room right now?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's kind of a paradoxical thing of recognizing that things are happening outside of our conscious awareness, and at the same time attempting to be conscious of them. And that's what the concept helps us do, is to reflect on the experience.
Yeah, of course, Jung visited Africa, and so that was one of the places, I think, where he developed this idea about how so-called primitives, what their consciousness was like and their experience. And you noted that he used the term a priori consciousness as another word to kind of describe this, which actually reminded me of Freud's distinction between primary process and secondary process thinking. And so to me, it smacks very much of primary process thinking, which is that distinction's always has made a lot of sense to me.
Absolutely. And Jerome Bernstein, in his chapter, he's not directly addressing primary process, but he takes the terms that Freud and others have used, like pre-logical thinking. And he, instead of saying pre-logical, he makes a nice shift, and he says it's trans-rational thinking, which is a little bit different. It's saying this is a different point. He's saying it's not that this is pre-logical, meaning inferior. It's that it's operating out of a different mindset, a different way of being, that rational thought, the thought of the secondary process, can't really address.
Right. And with all the interest in the brain these days, and you touch on some of the neuroscience that might be related, a more modern take on this might be what would be called right brain thinking, it seems to me. And it puts me in mind of the book by Julian Jaynes on the bicameral mind, in which he argued that there had been a change in consciousness over time. And more recently, Ian McGilchrist's work on brain lateralization, in which he says we've lost an earlier mode of consciousness in our culture with our focus on left brain, logical, sequential thinking.
Right, and so it's the most contemporary research. What McGilvery is highlighting is this notion that it's not actually that one does one thing and one does another, and somebody can be right-brained or left-brained. We're always both right and left-brained, and there are networks, but that out of the cultural influences, we've become overly dependent on that rational style of thinking, and that we've lost some things in the process.
Exactly. Now, in as much as we're talking about altered states of consciousness, loss of ego boundaries, unitary experience, and such, I was surprised that there's no mention of the role of psychedelics. You do have a chapter by Deborah Bryan on participation mystique and Peruvian shamanism, and of course there the role of ayahuasca plays a big role. So
right, there's different schools in the shamanistic cultures, and the particular one, the Cuero shamans that she's worked with, do not use hallucinogenics in their practices. So there are different avenues in, and the thing I wanted to emphasize in not addressing psychedelics is that psychedelics can certainly provide an experience of participation mystique, and that's one of the reasons they're being reevaluated in several universities with the approval of the FDA for treating extremely intractable depression. Because these psychedelic experiences allow the individual to feel a sense of connection with something greater than themselves, a connection often described as connection with the universe. and that this actually gives some of these people with severe intractable depression a sense of hope that there's something outside their own feeling of meaninglessness and emptiness.
Yeah, in fact, I just saw a special on CNN recently. It sounds like I do nothing but watch TV. But I have to balance this heavy Jungian reading with popular culture. And so there was this special on CNN where they were looking into shamanism and ayahuasca in mm-hmm. South America for the treatment of severe PTSD among veterans. And it was very fascinating. And, okay. And it kind of shows how this sort of thing is beginning to enter the mainstream culture, at least some awareness, some discussion of the transformative potential of psychedelic experience to perhaps produce a profound change.
Right. And the reason I stayed away from that particular discussion of the psychedelics is I wanted to emphasize in the book that even though the book is somewhat technical and geared towards people doing depth psychology, that this is, it sounds esoteric, participation mystique, but it's actually quite common. It's happening all of the time. We're in it all of the time, and we don't even realize it. You know, when we go to a football game and everybody wants to wear a jersey, you know, and everybody is doing the wave. These are all experiences, and they feel good afterwards because they feel, even though this thought isn't occurring in their minds, they feel like they've met with their tribe, essentially. You know, these other fans.
Yeah. And I can remember being at football games when I was in college and graduate school, and if the crowd roared or the band started playing, and sometimes I would get a real lump in my throat and have to choke back tears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really gets at what you're talking about. And in a way, it was a little embarrassing because I realized, boy, this must have been what it was like to be in a Nazi rally. You know, that kind. We have this capacity for a sort of group hysteria, if you will.
And that's the shadow. What Jungians would call the shadow side of this experience mm-hmm. is, yes, the Nazi rallies are a wonderful example of how the blurring can have a very dark effect.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, a theme that seems to run through the book is the role of transference, identification / introjection, and projection in relation to participation mystique. Perhaps you can take us through those dynamics now.
Okay. It's really amazing when you read some of Jung's descriptions of participation mystique, and then you spring forward 40, 50 years to the work of Melanie Klein around what she termed projective identification. And the language they end up using is almost identical.
Hmm.
And so Jung was primarily using these two terms, identification and projection. And Klein blends the two. So the idea is that in projective identification, one person has a bit of psychological experience that is either uncomfortable for them or which they want to protect and keep safe. So they, in order to, if their inner world feels hostile, they want to keep the thing that's valued safe. So unconsciously, they project it onto the other individual, the therapist. Now, what they hope, unconsciously again, is that the therapist will pick this up and act as though this bit of experience is now in them. And that's the identification part. So they, if somebody projects something to onto us and we identify with it, then we have taken it in a bit. Now, the piece about projective identification is the person doing the projecting then subtly interacts with the other individual to elicit a response from them that confirms that the projection was accurate. Now, all of this is taking place on an unconscious, not a conscious level. It's not a manipulation. That's conscious. Yeah. This is all going underneath the surface of awareness.
You know, this is also making me think of marital dynamics.
Absolutely. We do that all of the time in marriage. We take a bit of our own unfinished business, project it onto our spouse or our partner, and because we're so certain of the validity of our perception, we then begin to act as though they have this quality. And maybe they have just enough of it to make it feel accurate and real, but we're interacting as though it's 100% accurate.
And then we get upset when they don't conform to our expectation that we've, our unconscious expectation that we've formed.
Or, yes, we get upset if they don't play their part of the role.
Right.
Or we get, or the other thing that happens is they do act in accordance with our expectation, and then we feel validated in our perception. And then it's even more difficult to dislodge.
Yeah.
So withdrawing the projection and saying, oh, this is a bit of my stuff that I need to be attending to, gets increasingly difficult.
Yeah. Okay, let's, we're going to move into more of the book. I just want to talk a little bit about the structure of it here. First of all, people should know that unlike many, that you're the editor of the book, but unlike many other edited books, these are not articles that appeared elsewhere, but you actually approached people and asked, would they be willing to write an original piece to go in this book? Is that right?
That's correct. It was really a great experience soliciting the participants, some of many of whom I knew, but several of the participants I just cold called and said, hey, I've read some of your writing. I really admire what you've done, and I think you might have some interest in these areas. And so three of the chapters come from people that I had no contact with or limited contact with before the book.
Okay. And as editor, you wrote the introduction, an introductory chapter, and then there are, it's divided into three sections. One is called clinical applications, a second section is called experiential narratives, and a third is called theoretical discussions. And you also wrote a chapter of your own in that first section. And so that's kind of the structure of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to our interview, I suggested that you identify a paragraph or two from each chapter to read to us, both to give us a flavor of the author's writing and maybe a sense of the heart of their particular point of view. And you did share one from the introductory chapter about the leaf. Did you find anything else there that you wanted to read before we move into the other ones?
Yeah, there is a short, very short quote from Eric Neumann, who I quote in the introductory chapter, and he speaks about participation mystique with a slightly different language and talks about it as unitary reality. And he says, we have lost our sense of unitary reality, our experience of identity and of the sympathy of all things. And as a result, we have fallen into solitude and isolation of a dead and empty cosmic space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, to me, that's quite a beautiful passage.
Yes.
And also a sobering passage. And You know, he wrote that probably 60 years ago, and yet it's quite prescient to the things we face today. And, for example, the denial of global warming, I think Neumann would say that's a direct reflection of our lack of connection to our planet, our environment.
Right.
That if you were really empathically, sympathetically connected to it, you wouldn't have to deny it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you would feel it.
Yeah, and there's, you know, many writers have, you know, in recent years have really written on this theme. And when you first approached me about Participation Mystique, you know, I had a little trouble latching on to the idea or getting what it was about or thinking that it was very widely applicable. But that quote and others, I begin to realize that actually it is, as you've been emphasizing, a kind of universal experience that manifests itself in many ways, but there are important ways that we can all tap into it, into that concept, and get some usefulness out of it, whether we're analysts or not.
Exactly. And for analysts, I think it's a very useful, what I think of as an umbrella concept, a concept that a wide variety of other concepts fit neatly under.
Yes.
And so it's more like, rather than thinking of it as a single concept, to think about it as a very broad phenomenon that can cover a wide variety of conceptual material.
Sure. Well, let me have you step us through each of the subsequent chapters. And perhaps for each one, you can tell us a little bit about the author and their point of view, and we'll see what that discussion stimulates as we go along. And
okay.
I don't know if we'll have time to cover all the chapters, but let's see how it goes.
Okay.
And you may want to, I don't know if you want to start with the quote that you have for that chapter or weave it in later. But so starting in the section Clinical Applications, and chapter one is titled Negative Conjunctio and Sadomasochism in Analysis, and that's by Pamela Power. So take us through that a bit.
Pamela's a Jungian analyst in Los Angeles and is former director of training there. And I had, this was the one somewhat of an exception. I had heard her give this paper as a presentation. And I asked her if, and was impressed by it, and asked her if she could convert it to an actual publishable paper, because she utilized a lot of film excerpts as illustrations for the chapter. And she did very successfully, I think, translate that very visual auditory presentation into a very enjoyable and informative chapter. So she is talking about, again, another kind of esoteric Jungian language thing, conjunctio, which is a term. Jung used a number of terms from old European alchemical texts.
Right.
And so the conjunctio, taking Pamela's language, is a constellated archetype between two people, which becomes a highly charged energy field. This is where danger as well as new possibilities arise. When the conjunctio becomes enacted between analyst and analysand, technically it's acting out. However, there are situations where this enactment, along with the danger it brings, is a necessary stage for any significant psychological development. Any negative conjunctio, which literally means sacred marriage or sexual intercourse between two people. Now, a lot of these ancient alchemical texts talked about chemical reactions as conjunctio, this coming together. And what she's pointing out is this negative conjunctio, which becomes constellated around negative energies that, and the way she talks about it is in terms of what she calls envious pairings, which means a dynamic between two people that's based in envy. and also in an exploration of sadomasochism, in which there are two roles to play, and one person has to be present with their half of that role, primarily dominance and submission. So she goes on and says, when it becomes a dominant theme in analysis between analyst and analysand, this indicates that the analysis has become a necessary agent to modify the destructiveness and resistance that it indicates. So what she's really getting at here is that for some analyses, unless this negative conjunctio gets constellated, you don't really get at these darker, destructive, sometimes darker, erotic, and sometimes resistive features that have to be worked through in any analysis that's going into depth.
Uh-huh. So in other words, she's not really portraying it in a totally negative light, but actually saying that it's potentially a positive development in the analytic relationship if it can be elicited or invoked. Is that right?
Well, not so much that it can be elicited or invoked, because that would be kind of a manipulative use of
it. Okay, yeah.
But more so that you're aware, that the analyst is aware, that this can come into the room, and that rather than trying to keep it out, as is our tendency often in the helping professions, we want things to be unruffled. We want things to be nice. The therapist often defends against the emergence of negative emotions in the therapy relationship. And so what she's saying is, when we defend against these things like envy and like sadomasochistic dynamics in the therapeutic relationship, then we're keeping out a necessary stage of the process.
Mm-hmm. Now, is part of what's implied with this be characterized as a power struggle?
Absolutely. Sometimes that's the case. As Pamela points out in her chapter, the therapeutic relationship is set up for these dynamics to emerge, because the patient comes wanting help, and that because they feel some sort of deficit in their life or in their own personality. Now they're coming to somebody who they think has some answers for them and therefore must have some knowledge of these things that they want. So there's the setting, there's the stage is set for envy. I want something, you have it, and now I'm angry that you have what I want and I don't have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got
it. So right there, you're into it.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, that's helpful. Let's move on to the second chapter, you're ready to move on.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I think just giving everybody a little flavor of how the different approaches will be useful.
Yeah. We have kind of a smorgasbord here of very interesting and provocative and challenging ideas. So chapter 2 is titled Trauma, Participation Mystique, Projective Identification, and Analytic Attitude by Marcus West. So what does Marcus bring to the party, so to speak?
Well, Marcus is a Jungian analyst from England who I met at the Montreal International Meeting for Jungian Analysts in 2010, and I was impressed by Marcus's intelligence and clarity around these issues. He writes quite a bit around trauma. And he's really trying to take an in-depth look at how participation mystique in the form of projective identification that we talked about earlier becomes the vehicle by which the trauma comes into the consulting office. In other words, we're not simply helping somebody work through their old traumas. The trauma actually has to be recreated in some way in the analytic relationship for it to be truly alive.
Mm-hmm.
As Thomas Ogden, a San Francisco analyst, says, we can only do real psychological work with a bit of lived experience. So analysis done well is never an intellectual exercise. It has some an intellectual overlay in terms of the things the analyst might be thinking about, but in terms of getting at the depth of the experience, it has to come into the room in some way. And that's really what Marcus is focusing on. And if I'll just read a paragraph or two from near the end of his chapter, where he says, it is for this reason that the process of analysis with patients who have experienced early trauma is on the deepest level essentially one in which the analyst, through the process of participation on mystique, slowly comes to experience an equivalent to the patient's early trauma through the patient's reenactment of that trauma upon them. The analyst can then and only then speak from experience and properly contain and help the patient to recognize the impact of the trauma and how this manifests in their fundamental, implicit ways of being with others.
Nice, nice. That's really, that says it well. And, you know, it also, you know, rings true with just the impression that I have of what psychoanalysts, not just Jungian analysts, but the whole idea of the transference that occurs and the, well, as you've been saying, the transference and the projection and the kind of acting in the relationship, seeing the therapist in terms of important others and important experiences in one's life and having that become an alive thing.
Right.
In the room.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, the third chapter is written by all people, by you, and it's titled Watching Clouds Together, Analytic Reverie, and Participation mm-hmm. Mystique.
Okay. Yes, it's got a little bit of a French lilt to it.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I'll try to get it down. Yeah, tell us about your chapter.
Well, this is really coming out of my growing edge as an analyst. I've been doing work as a psychologist since 1988 and got certified as a psychoanalyst in 99. And really, over the last decade, coming to realize that it's the work of analysis is opening the analyst, opening themselves up to their patient's experience, but also to their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And to the notion of reverie is almost to slip into a dreamy-like state, like a daydream almost, mm-hmm. but where you're still observing what you're daydreaming.
Yes.
That it become anything that comes up in my body, you know, a tightness, a feeling of relaxation, a tingling, a rapidity of my heartbeat, anything that shifts and catches my notice, anything that it shifts in my emotions, any fantasies that emerge, any images that float into my mind, but also into any psychological concepts. So it can be a wide variety of things, and it's about relaxing my consciousness so that I'm not goal-directed in an analytic process, that I'm waiting to see what comes up, kind of like the idea of pulling the spoon through the stew. And as you pull the spoon through the stew, the potatoes and the meat and everything floats up to the surface. And you think, oh, that's beautiful. And our reverie is like that. And I think it takes a bit of time for new therapists and new analysts to get to the point where they're not so concerned with how to do therapy, that they're just doing therapy, and then that creates a psychological space for more of this reverie to occur.
Yes. Well, that's a really clear explanation. I really get it from what you've said. Were you able to, I know you wrote the whole chapter, so you're probably in love with it all, but were you able to find a couple of paragraphs that really capture it for you?
Yeah. Let me start off with actually a quote from a French philosopher, Raphael Enthoven, that was in the New York Times several years ago. And he says, it's a longer piece than I've included here, but it'll give you a flavor of his writing. And he really captures the essence of it. He says, "Daughter of consciousness and sleep, reverie blends their realms. Like intoxication, reverie is lucidity without an object, an activity, but one that's passive, a search that begins by giving up and lets itself be dazzled rather than looking. It remains happily somewhere between imagination and the ability to put it to use. Reverie is contemplation from within, letting the person who gives way to it feel its charge. Born of the desire and not the need to be directly involved in our surroundings, reverie strips the world of its utility. It borrows the power of narration from wakefulness and the power of divination from sleep, and keeps them vying to suspend the alternation of day and night. Reverie is how one arrives at immediacy. Reverie never rests."
Wow, I really like the last couple of sentences there. And did you have another passage?
Let's see.
I'm not saying you have to find one, but I thought you might have.
I'll read another passage from my own writing. Reverie isn't simply allowing oneself to daydream where there isn't an interaction with the flow of thoughts and ideas and sensations. The stance adopted is similar to Jung's active imagination, in which a relationship or stance is established with the internal flow. Active imagination, which has been described as dreaming with open eyes, is a technique developed by Jung to facilitate the engagement and assimilation of unconscious processes while in a relaxed but waking state. It's important to note, however, that Jung saw active imagination as an activity primarily engaged in by the analysand, which at times might be facilitated by the analyst. He didn't see active imagination, therefore, as something to pursue by the analyst during analytic sessions. And that's where another British psychoanalyst, Wilfred Bion, comes in. He picked up this idea of reverie and really made it an idea about how to be with one's patients.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll end there.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next chapter, 4, which is titled Modern Kleinian Therapy, Jung's Participation Mystique, and the Projective Identification Process by Robert Waska.
Okay. And Waska's a guy I became familiar with. He's also a West Coast psychoanalyst who practices what's called modern Kleinian psychoanalysis, developing from the theories of Melanie Klein. And I had written a review of one of his books and was impressed by his writing style as well. And I was surprised he was very receptive to writing the chapter didn't have a familiarity with Jung's, much familiarity with Jung's works. So I sent him some quotes from Jung about participation mystique, and he took it from there. Waska writes, "Contemporary Kleinian thinking includes the idea of projective identification as the core of all transference phenomenon, and most patients' internal world of fantasy conflict. Klein's discovery of the paranoid schizoid position, the depressive position, and projective identification have set the stage for contemporary clinical understanding of our patients' struggle with object relational issues. Jung's concept of participation mystique involves a mystical connection or identity between subject and object, in which the subject cannot clearly distinguish himself from the object, but is bound to it by direct relationship, which amounts to a partial identity. It is a transference relationship in which there is an influence directed at the person or thing. As a result, there is an identification with it. Participation mystique involves a non-differentiation of subject on object and hence a primitive unconscious state of identity. And he goes on to say, Jung's concept is very similar, if not identical, to the Kleinian notion of projective identification, especially in terms of the blurred reality between self and other, the influence upon the object and the subsequent identification that takes place. Mm-hmm. And I'll stop the quote there and just what Waska does is develop this idea through explanation of or exploration of a particular case in which this person, the patient, wasn't offering anything in the analytic process. In other words, he was making Waska, or wanted Waska, to do all of the work.
Right.
So that he didn't have to think, didn't have to be affectively involved, didn't have to be influenced by the therapy. Now, that sounds paradoxical. Why would somebody come to therapy if they're going to behave in that manner?
But it's fairly frequent, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is his way of unconsciously communicating what his predicament is. Mm-hmm. And so if we look at projective identification or participation mystique as not just a blurring of identities, but also a way in which we actually communicate our needs, our wants, our fears. And what he was doing was constellating certain feelings in Waska and then trying to get Waska to act in accordance with those feelings. Now, Waska's task is to be aware that that's what's going on. So rather than just be reactive to those pressures, he can instead interpret back to the patient, this is what I feel is happening between us. And this is why I think it's happening. Now, he doesn't state it quite as bluntly as I'm stating it here, but that's the idea. That's what the interpretation is, to give back the projection to the patient so that the patient can then begin to reflect on it as a part of his own experience.
And somehow to do it in a way that's not blaming.
Right. That's the key, is that if it's blame. And certainly every therapist can end up blaming their patient in some unintended way. That's why these concepts are important, is it helps us think about them instead of why is this patient doing this? It becomes really a question of why is this patient? What is the defense processes mm-hmm. that are in place?
To the extent that you're able to really enter into their world through this participation, perhaps that also helps you to not be blaming, but to have some empathy and to kind of come from that place.
Right. Exactly. And that's what Waska goes into, what West went into, essentially what Power went into. That's a recurring theme, is this is a way of developing empathy for the predicaments our patients bring to the consulting room.
Okay. Well, let's move on to part two, which is experiential narratives, and that's an intriguing possibility there. And so chapter five is Songs Never Heard Before, Listening and Living Differently in Shared Realities by Diane Braden.
Yeah, and Diane's one of the colleagues I consult with regularly, and she really has a gift for writing and for being soulful. And her chapter is a departure from the previous chapters. She includes some clinical material with one particular patient, but it's really focused on her experience. She lives in Cleveland or outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and it was in the winter. And she writes about this writer's retreat that she went to in Hawaii and about how she was impacted by her environment. And not just, that's beautiful, but really feeling like the environment got inside her, the world of Hawaii and this particular kind of rural retreat place that she went to got inside of her, the sounds, the smells, the textures, the creatures that inhabited it, and how fear, for example, got constellated at some point when she felt the primalness of the place. All of these experiences are really what she's talking about, what we could call participation mystique of place. And then she brings it back to her return to Ohio and then how that began to shape and influence work with one particular patient. So it's very much written from the first person and from a non-theoretical perspective.
Do you have a sample of her writing for us?
I want to take a little piece from near her conclusion. So I'm left with the recognition that participation mystique represents for me a bridge between the world of the psyche and the world of my concrete body, the world of the other and the world I see as mine. These worlds are filled with perceptions, beliefs, sensibilities, fantasies, and landscapes whose boundaries are more permeable than I'd ever thought possible until I went to Kauai on a writer's retreat to escape the participation mystique of another Ohio winter. The self, in Jungian terms, is nothing if not ironic. But these experiences point to more than a wry reflection based on the awareness that things didn't go as I expected. It's hard to miss the importance of these large iron gates one meets in a lifetime, gates whose opening changes our perceptions of what we see and hear. This experience certainly accomplished that for me personally and professionally and from such an unexpected teacher. Of course, I take Jung's caution about the danger of the numinous to heart and know that while participation mystique is an interesting and useful new tool, it is not the only or the best or the ultimate of analytic tools, nor is it the wrong tool if entered into unsuccessfully, but it deserves a place of recognition that I think it's been deprived for some time. And I'll skip a section I'll go to this section. I have long believed there is an aesthetic of soul discernible more easily in the dreams and fantasy I'm privileged to witness in the course of the analytic work I do. But I feel like now I've been given another dimension of psyche's beauty, and I've tucked it away in the reference department of my consulting room attention.
Mm. Yeah, she does write in a lovely way, soulful way, as you said.
Yeah.
The next chapter, 6, Variants of Mystical Participation by Michael Eigen.
Yeah, Eigen's really an incredible guy. This is one of the authors that I've respected his work. He's probably published 30 books in the psychoanalytic literature and hundreds of articles. I cold contacted him and said, here's what I'm working on. I think you might have something to say about it. And interestingly, he told me his first analysis was with a Jungian. And so he was delighted to have an opportunity to revisit his Jungian original roots. He's trained as a relational psychoanalyst, practices in New York. And he does an interesting thing, and this is the kind of thing Michael does, is he's always turning things on their ear. So he takes the phrase participation mystique, turns it around, and it becomes mystical participation. And it's the kind of wordplay that Michael's really gifted at. Let me just jump in and give a flavor, because it's... This is the only chapter I cried when I read it.
Wow.
And I couldn't even tell you now why I was crying.
Yeah. Okay.
But I knew that Michael had successfully done exactly what I hoped he could do, which is to not tell me about participation mystique, but to actually create an experience in the moment with the reader.
Wow.
That's what he's gifted at.
Yeah, what a gift.
Yeah. So mystical participation, is it a state that underlies experience? Can we better say it as a dimension of experience or sets of dimensions rather than situate it below, above, or earlier, later? What you and I might mean by mystical or participation or related terms may not be the same. I'm not sure what I mean, but loosely refer to something sensed. It may occur in varied affective keys, dread, awe, love, heaven, hell, joy, ecstasy, horror, hope, hate. Yes, there are hate frenzies, hate ecstasies, hate unions, destructive as well as creative mystical participation. There are those who say that destructive union is part of creativeness. Dimensions, plural. Mystics speak of going through many doors, worlds, gates. Beatrice in Dante's Heaven goes from one heaven through another. Heaven keeps opening. Invagination is often an implied image. In my early 20s, after a physical intervention by a somatic therapist, he asked how I felt, and I spoke the truth. I said, I feel like a vagina. My whole body became vaginal. His paranoid aspect came to the fore, and he said, how do you know how a vagina feels? And at that moment in my experience, I was one. So that gives you a flavor for how he plays with images and words, and really he's not trying to tell you something.
Uh-huh.
He's bringing you into an experience.
Yeah, I really got a feeling for that. Well, I think we have time maybe for just one more, and we want to give people an incentive to go ahead and get the book and read the remaining three chapters after this one. So let's just finish up with Chapter 7, Participación Mystique and Peruvian Shamanism by Deborah Bryan, who actually I interviewed here as well.
That's right. Yeah, she's got a couple of books out herself on Peruvian shamanism and her experiences with that on a personal level, going through training as a Jungian analyst at the same time she was participating in the training of these Quero shamans.
Yes.
So I'll just jump into the middle of her chapter. The psychological organization of the underlying participation mystique dynamic that is most frequently manifested within the context of the modern world is not the same as the experience in indigenous cultures, and therefore does not hold the same meaning. This is because the etiology of the phenomenon is dependent upon and a direct byproduct of the existing collective cultural experience. In any culture, the information we distill from our experience shapes the way we perceive and interact with our environment, informing the assumptions we make and ultimately creating the narrative we form about the world. Now I'll skip forward. The Quero, this is the tribe that these shamans come from, grow up in a village community called an Ailu and depend on their physical endurance and support of their Ailu to survive. Living in close contact with the simplicity of nature is very different from days spent existing in the comforts of modern living, a kind of virtual world comprised of automobiles, air conditioning, television, digital music, cell phones, and computers. While providing convenience and comfort, these modern accommodations insulate us from the natural rhythms of life associated with manual work, changes in weather patterns, communal gatherings, and non-mechanized travel. Quero, Pacos, these are the shamans, perceive and experience the world primarily through their senses using their bodies. Pacos track everything going on around them, whether it is noticing the movement of the apushin, a condor flying overhead as a manifestation of the spirit world, discovering a quail or sacred stone lying in their path, or noticing a tingling sensation in their bodies when they are sitting on a waka or power spot. So I'll end there.
Okay, well, that does give us a feeling for the experience that she had and writes about. And so, as I say, we're going to skip over the section three, which is theoretical discussions. And so I really invite listeners to, if they're at all drawn to the sorts of issues we've been speaking about here and want to learn more about them, to get your book and to dive into it. So,
and I'd be remiss if I didn't say, let me say something of appreciation for Susan Bostrom Wong, who is a Jungian analyst in San Francisco and who did the cover art for this book that is just very beautiful, I have to say.
Yes.
And she did a cover for a colleague of mine, Earl Shalit's book on Enemy, Cripple, Beggar, Shadows of the Hero. And she asked me what I'd be interested in. And it was so amazing working with her because I described what was in my mind's eye. And she sent me this picture she painted that was so close to what I had in my mind's eye that it was just breathtaking.
Okay, so if you listeners want to know what that picture looks like, go out and get the book.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. So, Dr. Mark Winburn, thanks for being my guest again on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David. I really enjoyed it again, and hopefully we'll have more discussions in the future if I keep writing.
Okay. I do hope that you enjoyed this discussion with today's guest, Jungian analyst Dr. Mark Winburn. As I believe I said during the interview, I was initially put off a bit by the term participation mystique. It was not a term that I've ever heard of, and my first impression was that it might be too arcane a concept for my shrink wrap radio audience, maybe even for me. The very term participation mystique to me seemed to smack of professional mystification. That is, I thought this might be an instance of creating a special technical vocabulary where more ordinary words might suffice. I still think that it might be possible to come up with a more contemporary term, but I do understand that for historical reasons Dr. Winburn took us through, we may be stuck with the French participation mystique. As I got more deeply into reading both Dr. Winburn's introduction and the other articles, I began to open up to the concept and to see its importance in the therapeutic relationship, and I began to understand that its significance is not limited to the psychoanalytic or even Jungian analytic approaches, but to psychotherapy more broadly, or at least any approach that might be considered to involve depth psychotherapy, with such dynamics as identification, projection, and so on. I certainly relate strongly to the aspect of the phenomenon that could be characterized as a peak experience or a mini Satori experience. I've had a few of those myself, but the focus of the Shared Realities book, while touching on those private peak experiences, really is more about the melting of boundaries that can happen in the dyadic-therapeutic relationship. And I've certainly experienced that in the past when I was practicing psychotherapy. But I'm also thinking of special here-and-now intensity that can arise in the conversation between two good friends. That's a special kind of experience that I really treasure. And this has happened from time to time with close friends when we drop into the here and now of our relationship and really experience the intensity of the moment or perhaps have a shared experience of nature. And I'm sure some of you have had this experience as well. The phrase I like is unitary experience, emphasizing an intense realization of non-duality, the oneness of everything. I think those of you out there who are therapists or who really like to delve into the theoretical niceties of the Jungian approach will find a lot to ponder as a result of reading this book. You can order your own copy of the book, Shared Realities, very easily by clicking on the banner ad for it in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com. Well, this is the place where I normally would play a fundraising snippet that a listener has sent to me in audio. In this case, I did receive something like that from listener Alan Tabor, but instead of sending me a recording, he sent it to me via text, so I'll read it. And he writes, "My fundraising quote, I'm a regular contributor to Shrink Wrap Radio. You should be too. The reason I contribute is that I'm receiving something of value. I always learn something, and often something that changes how I view the world and myself. What could be more valuable than that? Keep Dr. Dave on the main line." So I thank Alan very much for that, and maybe we'll hear it again if he ever sends in a voice version, because it'd be so wonderful to hear it in his own voice. But I do hope you'll take it to heart either way. I'd also like to thank the following listeners who, since the last podcast, have gone to our support page and signed up to become regular donors. Actually, this time there's only one such person since the last podcast. My sincere thanks go out to licensed professional counselor Paul Austin. Thank you, Paul, for your support. Have I ever got a deal for you? Still, nobody has taken me up on my new giveaway incentive idea for a new donor who would commit to $10 or more per month. And this was for a knit golf shirt from The Gap with Shrink Wrap Radio embroidered in red up on the left lapel area. And it's a size small, but I believe it would work for either a male or female who wears that size. I originally had it made for one of my sons, but he doesn't want it. Well, have I ever got a deal for you? I will send it to the first person in the U.S. who requests it for free. No financial obligation. How's that? I'm afraid there are no new transcript announcements today. About 3/4 of our interviews have been transcribed by listeners such as yourself. You can take a look at the transcripts page on our site where all the transcripts and transcripts in progress are listed. Episodes that you don't see there need to be transcribed. Doing a transcript is another way that you can support Shrink Wrap Radio, and people who have done it tell me it's very rewarding because as they re-listen, they get the content at a much deeper level. And I've heard this over and over again. So drop me an email if you'd like to take one on. As you may know from recent shows, I'm currently doing some advertising here for Audible.com, which I feel very good about inasmuch as I've long been one of their customers. Like you, I love getting good audio content, Shrink Wrap Radio being a case in point. So I have a new audiobook recommendation for you. Since today's interview is with a Jungian, my Audible recommendation for you is Modern Man in Search of a Soul by C.G. Jung. And it's narrated by Christopher Price. Now you can listen to it, the easy way to read it. And you'll get 9+ hours of educational information from this unabridged audiobook. So this might be an ideal alternative way for you to tap into the Carl Jung goodness. Or you can choose any one of more than 165,000 titles for this introductory offer. And you can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, this is Andy Hunt of Practical Wellbeing. We're all on the couch with Dr. Dave, so let's snuggle up and, hey, mind those elbows.
Thanks, Andy Hunt of practicalwellbeing.com. Hey, folks, I could use some creative new short snippets like this. You can even use our message phone to record them, so there's no excuse not to. Now let's turn to some recent email from our listener community. You know, earlier I read the fundraising appeal that Alan Tabor sent me in an email, and in addition to other fundraising suggestions, he wrote the following, and I quote, "Also ask for folks to donate to pay for new pieces of equipment that you might need. I learned a fair amount about all this on the board of my son's school. Even if money all ends up in the same place, folks feel quite differently about different types of contributions. Some want to be generous, some want to see hardware. Well, I really appreciated this last idea from Alan because the 2009 iMac that I create these shows on is getting long in the tooth and slow. It would really help me on the production end to have a new fast Mac. So I'm wondering if Alan's suggestion would work. I could put another button on the support page that would say something like Dr. Dave's iMac Fund. So I'm wondering if Alan's suggestion would work. Would you be willing to contribute to a special Get Dr. Dave a New iMac Fund? Please write and let me know what you think of this idea. And Alan, I thank you for that idea. This next email comes from Mike in Ireland, who also speaks to the fundraising issue. And he writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I felt I had to write following your recent newsletter where you so courageously and forthrightly articulated your struggle with charge, don't charge for shrink wrap radio. In particular, how Sven's email seemed to really bring the subject to a critical and final point, allowing you to complete your process, regain your center, and reframe what shrink wrap radio is to you, a spiritual practice. I met this reflection with a mixture of relief and awe. Relief in the shape of the onerous sense of forthcoming loss I felt at the notion of this amazing content and remarkable legacy being enclosed forever behind a paywall. Even that word leaves me feeling uncomfortable. And awe that stems from the reflection that in the years I've been following Shrink Wrap Radio and in the interviews with your many guests, we as listeners occasionally get a glimpse of Dave the man, not just Dave the accomplished professor, the savvy interviewer, and committed and enthusiastic podcaster. It is your humanity, your public struggle with what is so important to you and to your myriad listeners, played out candidly amongst your audience, which renews my sense of how important it is for us as professionals to reconnect with our humanity, take risks on struggling with important matters out loud, and how in meeting Dave the man and witnessing his struggle, and now its conclusion, you have forged a connection deeper than just the production and consumption of content. You have connected me with that spiritual process by being witness to it. And so, as you have come to resolve the core of your own dilemma with Shrink Wrap Radio, so I have also been able to resolve my sense of impending obligation to regularly have to muster resources, attack, and breach the paywall erected around your work. I have decided to commit myself to continuing to financially contribute to your ongoing efforts by taking my appearance on the honor roll as a reminder that what you have done is to push responsibility back to us, your listening community, to value your work in a real and tangible way, rewarding your efforts and investing in the future of Shrink Wrap Radio. We appear on that list not just as a means for you to recognize our contributions, but also for us to remind ourselves that honor is knowing and doing something that is morally right. And I'm convinced in doing the right thing by continuing to contribute to Shrink Wrap Radio long into the future. With love and kind regards from Ireland, Mike Hackett." And Mike, I do accept that as a message of love and support and really appreciate you for it. And I thank you so much for the way you honor me and what you said. And that's what keeps me going. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone number at 415-830-4014. If you're outside the country, I think all you have to do is add a 01 to the front of it. 01415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. So thanks again to Jungian analyst Dr. Mark Winborn for making us aware of the participacion mystique and its significance. My next interview will be with California psychologist Dr. Marty Klein, who, according to his website, has been a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified sex therapist for 31 years. He's aimed his entire career toward a single set of goals: telling the truth about sexuality, helping people feel sexually adequate and powerful, and supporting the healthy sexual expression and exploration of women and men. So I'm pretty sure you're going to want to listen to that one. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.